thanks so much. It was great being with you last night. And Dick said how, you know, there's this kind of processing thing that happens in your brain. So I know how these conferences are because I attend things like this a lot. And in fact, I love to be able to come to conferences like this where I'm not actually speaking, you know, and sort of taking this stuff in. But I know what happens, and your brain sort of processes things. And so last night, I thought, okay, it's a Friday night, a couple of talks that will be a different kind of audience. And so there's sort of a Darwinian process that happens. And so the weak are weeded out very quickly. And so the people that show up on Saturday morning or for breakfast at 7 a.m., you know, I feel like, okay, well, these are the really strong water buffalo with the pointy, you know, horns that have survived natural selection. And so so what that means is I'm going to go a little deeper this morning. It's also morning rather than evening. And so, you know, because of the kind of stuff I do is an integration of economics and theology and philosophy. And today it's actually this morning going to be some integration of theology and natural science. You know, there's sort of different levels at which you can talk about these things. You can talk about them superficially and abstractly and generally, or at almost any point you can go really, really deep. I'm generally a shameless generalist, and so I like to sort of range over different topics. And so that limits the degree to which you can go deep. But I actually chose this as a career path because I've got many friends. My co-author and friend Guillermo Gonzalez, with whom I wrote The Privileged Planet, he is like one of these guys that's very narrow and deep. He studies galactic habitable zones and the formation of planets around stars, right? It's not just astronomy. It's a subset of astronomy, and he's one of the world's experts on that. And to pull that off, that means that every morning he wakes up at 6 a.m., and there's a thing called AstroPH that physicists and astronomers read, and it's all the papers that have been submitted to journals around the world get posted on this website, and you can keep up. Every day you see, okay, what's been submitted, what's been accepted for publication. And you have to do that. You have to do it continually or you get out of date really, really quickly. Just the amount of data in astronomy and physics now, the data doubles about every 2 years. It's even hard to give those estimates, but it's something like that. And so you can't do everything. You know, we're not omniscient and omnipotent. And so you can't both be a generalist and be a hardcore specialist. And so this is the trick, is to know enough about the details that you get it right, but also are able to kind of range over and to connect the different disciplines. So that's what I actually have tried to do. And so it's always a little bit worrisome because it's always possible that you'll have something that's out of date. So I always worry about that. But one of the issues I have spent years focusing on is this question of environmental stewardship, climate change, and those kinds of things. I'm interested in theologically. And what got me into the scientific details is that I wrote this book called The Privileged Planet, 2004, with Guillermo Gonzalez, whom I just mentioned. And so as a result, I was on campus talking about the planet, right? And so when you do that, everybody is talking about global warming and the health of the Earth and all these kinds of things. And I thought, gosh, this is actually relevant, and I'm a Christian, so started studying this. And Guillermo is actually, not officially, but he is actually an expert on this subject, and he follows it. But he's had, any of you that have followed this, his career, know anything about The Privileged Planet, know that as a result of coming out in favor of intelligent design and writing a book about it, he was badgered and persecuted at some of his teaching positions. At Iowa State, the atheist religion professor started a petition drive against him and drove him out. It was a nasty deal. And so for years, he was very interested in this issue, but he didn't have tenure. And so I said, Guillermo, don't open multiple fronts of a war, you know, at the same time. Let's just do one at a time. You can have all the fun fronts you want once you've got tenure. So he's tenure track at Ball State. And we do talk about this in lecture in private settings, but I've prevented him from writing op-eds on this issue, at least to date. So a lot of this is a result of my analysis as a philosopher of the arguments and then Guillermo's sort of gathering of the data. I speak on this subject two or three times a year, and there's always some kind of new wrinkle. And what I want to do then this morning in this first lecture is I want to do two things. The first is I want to do the general thing so that if you don't get, don't care about, don't follow the details of climate science, you will at least have a few questions that you can ask. And think of these questions as four sort of categories of things. So whenever you're trying to decide, well, I don't have the time to get into the details of this stuff, what should I think about some current news having to do with climate change, is if you can remember the four questions I'm going to give you, it will guide you. And if you're wondering, all the things I have ever done and ever written on, the thing that has gone the farthest is these four questions. I didn't know that would happen, but a former president of the Czech Republic actually used these in an op-ed a few years ago. So you never know the thing that you think, gosh, this is going to be world-changing, nobody hears about it, something you didn't even think about, you know, it goes really far. So I suppose some people have found it useful. So you're going to get some of the data, you're going to get some of the science, you're also going to get the kind of basic arguments that scientists think about, you're going to get my opinions about where these things are, and then probably the most important thing are these four really simple questions, all right? So first question, I said, is God green? Christians and the climate change controversy. I think that there is a natural reason why, in general, Christians ought to be interested and motivated to ask questions about environmental stewardship. It's not like, now so I have heard Christians that say, why should we care about the environment? Jesus is coming back, you know, anytime soon, so, you know, let's just burn everything down because it's all burning up anyway. I mean, sometimes people say that, but in fact, the Secretary of the Interior under President Reagan, James Watt, was accused of saying this. And when I have written on this, I actually looked this up, and it was a complete myth. In fact, what he said was, well, we don't know. Somebody baited him. Well, don't you think Jesus is returning? Why would you care about the environment? And he said, well, we don't know when the Lord is going to return, and so in the meantime, we should be good stewards. And Bill Moyer said that he said this Jesus is coming back, so who cares? And now that's what you hear. And so he still references. It was a complete lie. In fact, he's from someplace around here, I think. I'm forgetting where Watt was from. Where? Colorado. Okay. So, you can imagine a Christian saying that, but I've found very few that ever actually make that argument. I think we all kind of know intuitively, well, God created the world. He declared it good. He declared it good on all those days before we even showed up. And then he declared it very good when we showed up. And so I think there's a way to both incorporate the fact that human beings are part of the created order and are made stewards over it, be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over it. Dominion there doesn't mean rape and pillage. Dominion is the dominion of a benevolent king who has responsibility over territory. In this case, whether being a king or a vice regent, that God has placed in responsibility over the created order, at least this little part that we have some effect on. And so I think for that reason that, you know, we have every reason to care. We have every reason to care, one, because of human well-being. There's certain kinds of environmental problems. Fortunately, we've actually solved most of these that do directly affect the health and the well-being of human beings. Pollutants in water, for instance, sewage in water, really obvious things that we don't think about because we fixed them, that billions of people every day still have to deal with. Then stewardship of the natural world, which is just basically this idea that we have been made stewards, so we have responsibility. It's complicated how it works itself out. But we're not merely just passing through. It's a world that God's created and given us responsibility over. And then third, the fall. Why do I mention the fall here? Well, the reason is because of the fall, things are not the way they're supposed to be. We can mess things up in our families, in our cultures and societies, and in the environment. And so we shouldn't be utopians about this. And the problem is kind of bundling all these things together and separating the anti-human ideology that's very common in much of the environmental movement. And so that's what makes this issue sort of complicated. So let me just really quickly, here's the sort of three biblical verses. We could spend all day just on this. And the first is just the concept of stewardship in Genesis 1:28. This is how it reads. This is after God creates man and woman. And he says, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. So our dominion actually doesn't include Alpha Centauri. There's nothing we can do that affects Alpha Centauri or Betelgeuse, which is a big star, or anything like that. It has to do with essentially the surface and atmosphere of the Earth and maybe a few miles under the Earth. That's the extent of our dominion. And then, of course, in Genesis 2:15, notice that God takes the man, in this case, and he puts him in the garden to till and keep it. That's important to remember because this is before the fall. So in other words, this job that we've been given of exercising, and in this case, for Adam, tilling and keeping the earth, God provided the garden, but he expected the man to till and to keep it. And so that type of work is not the result of the fall. It's a part of the creation mandate. What the fall does is it makes work toil. It makes it tedious. It makes it unproductive. Work itself is a part of our created being. And I would suspect that even in the kingdom of God to come, that work aspect without the toil will continue to be a part of our existence. And then the fall, as Paul says, it doesn't just affect human beings, but in some weird way, it actually affects the creation. And Paul says in Romans 8:22 that the creation, the whole creation, has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth and travail until now. And so we have all the reason and all the motivation and foundation that we need to develop a good environmental ethic. We don't need Marx. We don't need left-wing progressive ideology. We can and should develop an environmental ethic that's sort of rooted in this foundation. And it will help us avoid the excesses of environmentalism, which often tend to treat human beings not as a part of the created order and as stewards, but as sort of cancer or parasites on the created order. Right? So that's the theology, and that's the theological background. So let's talk about global warming. And the funny thing is that, of course, the phrase has changed over the years. When I first started talking about it, it was global warming. A few years ago, it started to be climate change, and now it's become climate disruption. But any of you that saw the series Cosmos with Neil deGrasse Tyson that was on Fox and National Geographic during the spring, it's a redo of the Carl Sagan documentary from 1980. And it was a very high production value thing. Hosted by an American astronomer and sort of disciple of Carl Sagan named Neil deGrasse Tyson. And so there was an entire episode, the 12th episode, was devoted to this issue, and they didn't get the memo about the word change, and so they talked about global warming. So I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. But the basic claim is the same nonetheless. And so I want you to understand the science and why reasonable people can think that there's a problem. Now, I think there's problems with their argument, but I want you to see why this is not just something people made up. There's some sort of basic stuff in here. So what is the basic claim of global warming? People often say, well, do you believe in global warming or do you believe in climate change? Which is not a question that admits of an answer. You believe in climate change? I mean, well, of course. You know, we're not sitting here at absolute zero for eternity. Things change, so what do you mean? Do you think maybe it's getting warmer or colder? It's not clear. The problem with the word and the idea is that it bundles together completely different concepts and different arguments under a single term. And so what you're being asked often when you're asked that question is to sign off on different things, when in fact you could have a yes answer to one and a no answer to another. But here's the basic claim, is that that we are presently undergoing a certain kind of catastrophic climate change. So yes, of course the climate changes all the time, but the argument is that there's unprecedented climate change happening right now. And it's unprecedented enough that it would be catastrophic to life and to human civilization. So it's not just a silly idea that stuff changes. The second part of this is that it's human-induced. So in other words, yeah, of course the sun has something to do with climate, the tilt of the earth, sunspot cycles, all this kind of stuff. Of course they play a role in the climate. The claim, though, is that the unprecedented and catastrophic aspect of climate change is largely the result of human activities, and in particular releasing greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide and methane into the atmosphere. All right? So it's that claim. It's not that 100% of it is caused by humans, but the claim is that most of it is caused by human activity. And it's catastrophic. It's bad. So it could be maybe that there'd be climate change and humans are causing it, but it's not bad. So all three of those ideas are tied up together. The climate is changing in an unprecedented way. It's largely produced or induced by humans, and it's catastrophic. And so you can see how already you're seeing that there's different aspects even of the actual claim. Now, you see a picture here of I want to show you how images and this interpretation of the evidence and of activity sort of shapes the way we perceive even simple pictures. You see the picture on this Time magazine. This is from Earth Week a few years ago of a polar bear, and he's on a piece of ice, and he's looking down in the water. It says, be worried, be very worried. Or are they not? I can see it here. Thank you. You're all sitting there saying, advance the slide, he finally said something. There it is, I'm sorry. That's what I was talking about. All right, sorry about that. I've got this weird setup where I can see two slides at once. So there's the basic claim, if you didn't get those in your notes. And here's the picture I'm talking about. So notice this Time magazine picture. You've got a polar bear here. And the text, if you just saw a picture like that by itself, out of context, you don't really know what's going on. In fact, I would be willing to bet that what's going on is he's waiting for a seal to come up, right? I'd bet that's what's happening. But because of the text, you interpret it as what? The melting of the Arctic ice caps, there's not any place for polar bears, they don't know what to do, they're stuck on ice and they're probably going to drown. Right, that's what, you know, all of that interpretation gets packed into the way in which the text and the image is portrayed. Now, what's funny, a few years ago, another image that was used like this is a picture of polar bears on an iceberg. And there were ones up on the top, there's one in the water, and there's one on the side. And it was used for a magazine cover just like this. And the photographers protested, and it had to be retracted by the publication. And the reason is it was used, as, again, as an illustration of the Arctic sea ice melting when, in fact, they were just playing. And that's why the photographers got the pictures. They were literally climbing up to the top of the iceberg and jumping into the water, all right, which is kind of different. And so the thing is that these ideas so pervade us that it can be very, very difficult to have kind of get critical distance so you actually know what's going on. Now, why would anybody think that there is unprecedented climate change happening, that it's human-induced and it's catastrophic? Well, the argument's actually really basic and it's easy to understand, and so I'm going to just lay out the argument here. I know that I'm using bad PowerPoint practice here. This is not best practice to just have text, but what I'm doing, as I told you, we're going deeper. I'm going to show you exactly the argument that is presupposed so that you understand why people would think this. Our job is to understand the best arguments for or against a position, whether we hold it ourselves or not. Here's the argument. The first assumption, first premise, is that for decades, scientists have postulated that increases in carbon dioxide and other gases could lead to a greenhouse effect. Now, why would they think that? Well, I think that because you can actually do the experiment in the lab. We know from basic physics that molecules that have three atoms in them, like carbon dioxide, methane, there's an effect that infrared radiation, infrared light, has on these molecules. It essentially increases the energy. You could think of it roughly as a sort of, they absorb more of the heat that comes from the sun. That's imprecise, but that's the basic idea. And so the more of these things that you have in gas form in the atmosphere, the more heat is going to be trapped by the sun. We know this takes place. We know this is how the kind of basic chemistry and physics works. You can do it in a lab. And it's a very, very important effect. If we didn't have this, for instance, if the Earth were suddenly stripped of its atmosphere, even if we had oxygen tanks so we wouldn't suffocate, the Earth would become impossibly cold very, very quickly because the radiation coming from the sun would actually mostly disperse and wouldn't maintain itself on the surface. We know that almost certainly Venus is very, very hot, not because it's a little closer to the sun, but because it has an incredible amount of carbon dioxide in its atmosphere. I mean, inconceivable amounts. Earth's atmosphere has about 380, 390 parts per million, right? So a kind of trace amount. And so that sort of basic idea that the connection between carbon dioxide and greenhouse effect, that part's fairly well understood. It gets complicated really quickly, as you'll see in a minute, though. Second thing is the observation that the temperature overall, right, looking at the kind of overall trend, has risen during the 20th century while greenhouse gases have proliferated due to human activity. So these two things seems to be a theoretical reason why carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere would increase the temperature, and the temperature has gone up at the same time that these things, carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has gone up. Therefore, greenhouse gases are probably the cause. That's not that complicated, and the sort of really basic physics is not especially complicated. But the details, the devil is always in the details on these things. So that's the basic argument. Now, what are these four questions I told you about? Before I get into the scientific details that you'll forget anyway, probably, I'll forget. What are the four questions? Because this is what I think is really, really important. Whatever you finally decide about the specific scientific and political and economic claims, just simply from logic, you should be able to keep these four different questions and issues separate in your mind, and here they are. The first is this question, is the Earth warming? That's an observational question, or what philosophers would say, an empirical question. It's something that, in principle, you should be able to go out and figure out with a combination of really well-placed thermometers and maybe satellites over a period of time. You should be able to figure out if, on average, overall, the Earth's climate, the sort of average temperature of the Earth is going up or not. Right, so that is the Earth warming. That's something that admits of, you know, sort of observational evidence. So second argument, are we causing it? That is question. That is, are human beings and our activities the primary cause of this? Now, notice that you could say yes to one and no to two. It might be that the earth is warming and that we're not causing it, right? This is logic at this point. This is not science. It's just straight logic. The question of whether something is happening is a separate question from the cause of that thing happening. It's perfectly simple. So the ice caps could be melting. Hurricanes could be getting more severe. All sorts of crazy stuff could be happening with the climate that wouldn't by itself tell you what's causing it. Okay, so those are always two different questions. They have to be asked and answered separately. The third is the question that's never asked. Is it bad? All right, this question is submerged very, very deeply because people don't want you to say, okay, maybe we are causing the climate to warm, but maybe it's actually on balance good. Because that's the question. It's not whether any change is going to have some good and some bad. Almost any particular change you can think of is going to have a cost and a benefit. The question is always whether the costs outweigh the benefits or the benefits outweigh the cost. So it might be that, say, a net increase of 1 degree Fahrenheit is increase in the Earth's climate would, yeah, maybe it causes a drought here and there, maybe the sea levels rise a few inches here and there, but it vastly increases the growing season. It vastly decreases deaths as a result of cold weather and things like that, in which case it would be good, all right? So again, that's a third question. You've got the observational question, you've got the causal question, what would cause this, and you've got the evaluative question, is it good or bad? Separate question. And finally, would the advised policies make any difference? That is a political and an economic question. And so it could be that the Earth is warming, that it's a big disaster, that we're causing it, that it's really bad, and that there's realistically absolutely nothing that we could do about it. Right? That's possible. And so, but this, just even asking these questions is kind of in some ways an act of subversion because you realize, wow, every one of these questions leads to 1,000 other questions. And so it's almost impossible. If you have a really simplistic answer to all these things that doesn't realize these are different questions, you probably are thinking real fuzzily about the issue. And it gets really crazy. I'm part of a private group in Washington, D.C. is a group of all conservatives. But conservatives actually disagree on the answers to these questions. It's a private group. There's no records kept or anything like that because it's so controversial. And what we do is we invite people in on different questions that on one side and the other, we find the smartest people we can find on whatever issue we're going to have. And we are in there with them for 4 hours. And you'd be amazed at what people will say in that kind of forum. So people actually, the experts for the most part, actually know the answers and the complexities of this question. But only in those kinds of sort of private, protected forums do you actually get the details. I've been stunned by it. I've been doing it for a year, and I'm shocked by the things that people that I know and have argued with in public will admit when the cameras aren't on. All right, so let's answer these questions really quickly. Is the Earth warming? Did I do that right? Let me see here. Give me a sec. There it is. Is the Earth warming? Okay, well, the question always depends, unfortunately, even this, on something else. What's the baseline? Warming since when? Warming by how much? And so remember, when you're talking about a warming trend or a cooling trend, it doesn't mean that there's a straight line. It means that the trend is one direction or the other. And so it seems like if you anchored the baseline, said, when are we going to start the measure? About 1850. So that's a reasonable time to start it because that's when real industrialization started and significant amounts of greenhouse gases started getting put into the atmosphere by human beings. And so on that, I'd say there's actually fairly good agreement that if you were just to ask the question that way, there's about a degree and a half increase since the 1850s with declines from the 1940s to the 1970s. And as most of you have probably heard, it's flattened since about 1998. That still constitutes a slight warming trend just because you could have a slight trend that then flattens up here. And if you took a line and made the first point and the last point, it would still go up like this. But notice it's about a degree and a half Fahrenheit. And in fact, if you sort of move the anchor back, move it back to the last ice age or something like that, what you discover is we've been in a warming trend from that for a long time for sort of obvious reasons, right? You're either warming or cooling. And so if you're thinking of it in that way, you'd much rather be on the upswing than on the downswing. Another ice age is probably not the greatest thing in the world. So here's two different sets of data. And so these are data. One is the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, one's the Hadley Center. So these are two completely different sets of data. You can see the sort of up and down trajectory here. But notice the scale's very small. We're talking about tenths of degrees from 1850 to the present. And notice it leaves off, unfortunately, about 2000, so you don't actually see this, the flattening of it. Okay, so but that's just since 1850. So I think that's fairly well established, and it's independently verified both by satellites and by ground-based satellites. So I think, okay, yeah, sure, if that's the only question. Second question is, are we causing it? All right? Now, this is different from that prior question I was talking about the effects of CO2 and those sorts of things. So I think it's fairly uncontroversial among the people across the spectrum that follow the issue that the concentrations of CO2 in the atmosphere have gone up. This is the data from the Mauna Loa Observatory, which is on the top of a very tall mountain in Hawaii. That's a sort of the perfect place to measure this because the atmosphere is mixed really well there. And so what you're getting is a kind of perfect representative sample of the global temperature. If you did this in New York City, right, it would be off because New York City is not a representative sample. So this tells you what's been happening in this case. It's just going back since 1958. The details are kind of boring, and so I'll tell you, it seems to has been going up between 1 and 2 parts per million at least since 1958. And so it's reasonable to extrapolate back to say, oh, we're probably at 300 parts per million at the turn of the century, and then we're getting up toward 400 parts per million. So, but think what we're talking about, right? So we're talking way less than a tenth of a percent in the actual atmosphere. So CO2 is a trace gas. And this data, you know, because there's all these natural processes that put CO2 into the atmosphere and remove CO2 to the atmosphere, sort of average that out. And so it does seem, okay, yeah, we are adding a little more than would be there if we weren't doing anything. There were just the natural sources. I mean, the point is we couldn't get to zero. If humans cease to exist, there's going to be some CO2 in the atmosphere. All right, that's fairly uncontroversial. But here's sort of where the problems come. Remember I said, okay, so it looks like we're adding a bit to the atmosphere over time, and there's a slight warming trend with a lot of jaggedness happening more or less at the same time. But as everybody learns in their first statistics class, correlation isn't causation. Two things can correlate, right? You can have one that's associated with the other. It doesn't mean that one causes the other. And most of you probably have your sort of favorite example of what causes this. And so, you know, sort of famous studies that, you know, having a, just let's say, that you do a study and it turns out that having a television in your bedroom, you're much more likely to get lung cancer if you have a TV in your bedroom or something like that. You'd say, well, they correlate. So apparently having a TV in your bedroom gives you lung cancer. But what if, in fact, for some weird reason, people that have TVs in their bedroom also tend to smoke a lot? Right? That's just a correlation. And it's easy to establish correlations, and especially in things like nutritional science. 99% of nutritional sciences, correlations getting confused with causation. And so, you know, it's a sort of maddening thing. But just because these two things are happening, and just because we have a kind of theoretical way of understanding how one might be causing the other, that doesn't establish causation. The other thing is the theory doesn't establish past climate changes. So as I told you, there's a slight warming change, a warming trend since 1850, but if you work that back to 1000 AD, you end up hitting something called the medieval warming period. And so this was a period around the time of Christ for several centuries, and we know from records, you can also establish this with other kinds of data, tree rings carefully analyzed, lake bed sediments, stuff like that, that it was actually warmer in the northern hemisphere about 1000 AD than it is now. So miraculously, the polar bears survived that medieval warming period. I don't know how it happened. If you work your way back even farther, what you discover is there's absolutely nothing unprecedented about the slight warming trend we've been in, and it just sort of gets swamped by natural variation. So you know, we weren't dumping CO2 into the atmosphere in 1000 AD. And so we know there's got to be some sort of other major causes that may overwhelm whatever it is that human beings are doing. The other thing is we know of other natural causes that also seem to correlate with the climate change we experience. Here's the scarier look at that. Okay, so this is a random selection of 14 data sets at a time without duplicates. It shows this is the kind of variation in those things, but you can still see there's a cooling trend here. I said the time of Christ, there was a warming trend in the time of Christ, a Roman warming period, but the medieval warming period was, of course, 1000 AD, which is slightly after the time of Christ, right? So you see the warming trend here. You see there's actually a little ice age in the 1700s. You know, the Hudson River, the Delaware River used to freeze over around the time of the American founding. And so we've been in a warming trend since then as well. A weird cooling trend in the 40s and the 70s and back and forth. And so what are other causes? Well, there are a number of scientists, and strangely, a lot of them are in Scandinavia. That are solar astronomers that have discovered that, you know, there's a lot of various cycles and processes in the sun, including sunspot cycles and other cycles. And there is a remarkable correlation between certain of these solar cycles and the climate variations. And so at least it doesn't establish, again, its correlation doesn't establish causation, but it's at least plausible that the primary cause for the variation might actually be that big yellow dwarf star 95 million miles away here, right? And so that's not a crazy idea. And so this is why some scientists think it's more likely that we're dealing with solar activity. But the details are complicated, all right? So I would say, you know, it's not irrational to think human beings are there's some human contribution to climate change, but it's not anywhere near certain, and it's perfectly rational to think there's could very well be other things happening. That's my own personal assessment of the data. So the third question is it bad? Now, what's interesting about this is that if you read the IPCC, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is the big commission set up by the UN, and they issue these reports every few years, and nobody reads the actual scientific reports except for nerds that follow this. The media all read the summary for policymakers, which is written by poli-sci majors, and is often written in complete disconnect from the actual report. In the most recent IPCC report, they actually say that it's likely that near-term increase in climate is likely to have more benefits than harms. Now, they're still worried because they think, but in the out years, it's going to get past the beneficial point and get into the bad point. Most people don't know that. That, no, moderate warming, and this is the IPCC report from the UN, and that's sort of intuitive, right? The only way you could know that a slight increase is bad is if you already knew what the optimum global temperature was, right? The only note is like if you're going in a particular direction and you're trying to get somewhere, you don't know if you're getting near it or far, you know, away from it unless that thing is someplace, right? Problem is we don't know what the global climate optimum is because that would require figuring out all of the various benefits and costs of any particular climate. We don't have the ability to do that. And because there are always trade-offs, any kind of change, trade-off means there's a cost and a benefit. What you're always wanting to do is not say, well, I'm just going to focus on the benefits. What you want to do is do the thing in which the benefits exceed the costs. This is just sort of basic economic reasoning. And so that's sort of the question. I'm actually quite convinced that a moderate warming trend is actually a good thing. Quite obviously, if you know, you get there's some point, we don't know exactly where it is. If you get to 212 degrees Fahrenheit on average, bad, clearly, demonstrably, obviously bad. But we don't know where's the point at which the costs start to exceed the benefits. We don't quite know where it is. And so this is why, in fact, there's already evidence and a lot of data suggests that agriculture worldwide, and especially in the Northern Hemisphere, has gotten more productive, not just because of technology and hybridization, but because of increases in CO2 in the atmosphere. Of course, CO2 is plant food. You live in Montana, you know that. This is a picture of researchers actually in Arizona who do research on various kinds of trees, and we know that increases of CO2 in the atmosphere affects plants in different ways. Some plants, it doesn't make a lot of difference. In other words, they're not very sensitive to it, but others, you add CO2 concentrations and they proliferate. So what this is, the experiments are different trees in these little containers, and so what they do is, you know, one is a bristlecone pine and one is a scotch pine, and then they add different concentrations of CO2 and see what the effects are. And overwhelmingly, it's never a bad thing, but, you know, some plants actually are very responsive to increases in CO2. I had my daughter, the one year that she was in a public school, there was a science fair. Here's my stupid idea. And I say, oh, okay, so we're going to do a science fair. What shall I do, Dad? I said, let's test the effects of carbon dioxide on the growth of something. And so we did this with, what's it called, wheatgrass. With wheatgrass in these clear containers, and we used carbonated water. It was a complicated thing, and took pictures. And what we discovered is that when we added CO2 to one, carbonated water around it and regular water in the other, not only was the wheatgrass thicker above, but because we'd happened to plant these in clear pots, what we discovered is that the roots were twice as thick. It was hugely significant. And so it was actually a really scientifically significant. Well, the the judges were the local community college graduate students, and so she didn't do so well. But I told her, I said, "Hon, yours was the best." And so we know it's plant food. So in other words, there are lots of these kinds of things. It's carbon dioxide, yes, in the atmosphere, it functions as a greenhouse gas, but there are other things that it does. And this is actually the very heart of the debate right here. Because you're probably wondering at this point, okay, so why? If carbon dioxide is a very kind of slight trace gas in the atmosphere, and we're adding just tiny little bits to the atmosphere, why would you think it's going to be sort of radically different? We're not talking about adding 10, you know, making it 10% carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We're talking about trace amounts. Well, we actually know you can figure it out from basic chemistry and physics. If you're just talking about carbon dioxide additions in the atmosphere, it would probably, all things being equal, increase the global temperature about 1 degree Celsius for every doubling. All right, so you know what I'm saying? So for every doubling. So what that would mean is that you could double the total amount, so go from 300 parts per million to 600 parts per million, and you get about a degree warmer. Now you have to double it again. This time you got to get to 1,200 parts per million and then 2,400 parts per million. Well, this is going to get very hard very quickly to ever do that. And so that was not what it's going to do is it's going to level off. There'll be an effect, and then you'd have to really dump a lot of CO2 in the atmosphere in order to be able to add increases. And this is well known. This point I'm making is not controversial. So the question is, okay, so why is there this fear that it's catastrophic? It's because of something called feedbacks. And so what feedbacks are secondary effects of things that you do. So for instance, you could put trace amounts of testosterone in your body, you know, just milligrams, microscopic milligrams of testosterone. Let's say you're a woman or a teenage girl and you're injecting testosterone. It's tiny little bits, but because it's going to do certain things metabolically and hormonally in your body, it sets off a series of cascades that would result in radical changes in your body. Okay, that's because there's lots and lots and lots of positive feedbacks in the hormonal system. Positive feedback means that it magnifies the effect of something. And so the question is, the whole real scientific debate about climate change is the question of these feedbacks. And in particular, it's this question. Are the feedbacks positive or negative, or which ones are positive and which ones are negative? A positive feedback means it's something that magnifies the effect, so it makes it more severe. A negative feedback means that it mitigates or moderates the effect. So it's negative. It sort of bounces back. Your body has this. It's called homeostasis in your metabolism. Now, if your metabolism is working well, it turns out you can vary the amount of food that you eat, and you don't just suddenly die and starve to death. And if you're, when you're a teenager, I know I was this way, there was absolutely no amount of food that I could eat that would change my weight. I tested this very rigorously. I could eat entire pints of Haagen-Dazs ice cream and half a tub of peanut butter. 155, right? Just stuck. Now, what's happening? What's happening is that my body was adapting, wasn't it? So if I ate more food, it just cranked up the heat so that it burned more calories. And if I started eating less food, then it would slow down my metabolism. So see what it was doing? So it had a mechanism for positive and negative feedbacks to level it out. Now, there are limits to that, obviously. You can starve yourself to death, but there's still, you know, in your metabolism. It's the same thing in the climate. So there are processes that magnify effects, and there's processes that moderate effects. And so the whole debate is about those feedbacks. Now, some of you may know that, but probably most of you didn't know that all this complicated science actually boils down to really this one question. And probably 99% of the scientific debate among people on both sides centers on this one question. So what happens is that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change assumes both that they know what all the feedbacks are and that they're all overwhelmingly positive. All right, so all the models you hear about, complicated computer models that project what the climate is going to do in the future, are based not just on the variable, okay, we're adding CO2, but we're adding CO2 and all these feedbacks are going to magnify the effects. Right, and so it ends up being catastrophic. And so that's a real question. Is that true? Or are there feedbacks we don't know about? Or are some of the feedbacks that they think are going to make it worse are actually going to make it better? And we know there's some positive feedback. So let me give you one example. I know I'm getting down in the weeds, but you'll understand this issue better than 99% of the population if you stay with me. So here's would be one a positive feedback. So let's say that there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and so different surfaces on the planet reflect or absorb infrared radiation. So eyes, for instance, tends to reflect infrared radiation, so it, you know, so that it goes back into space. So imagine if you put CO2 in the atmosphere and it warms the Earth, and some of the ice that was on land melts. Well, land tends to absorb rather than reflect ice, and so that would be a positive feedback. The ice was bouncing the infrared radiation back, it melts, now the land is absorbing it, and so that ends up increasing the warmth. So you see how that works? That's a positive feedback. The issue, though, is that things like plants are a negative feedback, quite obviously. So if the more plants you know, the more CO2 there is, the more certain kinds of plants grow, they absorb the CO2 in the atmosphere. Another one that's, I think, is almost certainly a negative feedback has to do with high cloud cover, which for a long time was assumed to make things worse. It probably makes things better. It looks like the climate has a way of, it's like a metabolism of sort of adjusting the cloud cover to take account of these different things. And I think that is why, if you look, all of the models, and if you want to be really modest, 98% of the models predicted that we were going to be continuing to warm past 1998. They had to. There was just no way to work these models to get this weird cooling trend. And so now we've got 52 particular theories trying to explain why it hasn't kept warming. And so what's happening is that the models, based on the assumption that all these feedbacks are bad, are now completely out of sync with the actual observations of the temperature. And so we've got the data doing this, we've got the models doing this. So what that tells us is there's a theoretical assumption that's wrong somewhere in here. Whatever it is, it's very likely that there's a feedback that we're not taking account of. And so that's why I'm very skeptical of the catastrophic scenarios, not because I don't think CO2 is a greenhouse gas or any of those things, but the data itself should be conforming to the predictions if we had any reason to think it were true. And so it gets funny. In fact, there are websites that follow excuse of the day, excuse du jour for why it's not warming, where the heat has gone, you know. And it gets actually quite humorous. All right, so the fourth question, again, is would it make any difference? All right, so let's assume, though, that let's assume the models were tracking or the data was following along with these predictive models. Would the advised policies make any difference? Well, at the moment, there isn't actually any international policy. What we had for years was a treaty that was signed in Kyoto, Japan, and it was called the Kyoto Protocol. And so this was essentially a UN-authorized international meeting. And so the Kyoto Protocol said this. So if a country signed on to it, what they did is they agreed to reduce their CO2 emissions to 5.2% below 1990 levels. All right. So what this meant in many cases is that countries would actually have to reduce the amount of CO2 that they were releasing into the atmosphere, and to get it back down below that. Most countries that signed this in Western Europe and badgered the United States, who this was under President Clinton, the Senate rejected it 95-0 and didn't sign it. If you look at the record, the United States actually did reduce its CO2 emissions, and I don't think one country that actually signed it did. And so everybody knows the PR is good. Just sign it and do what you're going to do anyway. So that's what happens. Here's the funny thing about the Kyoto Protocol. Let's assume all the countries had signed on to it and had complied. The official estimate is that by 2050, it would have resulted in a 0.07 degrees Celsius reduction in the rate of warming. This isn't even measurable. This is so small and trivial. Not even measurable. And this is if there had been complete compliance. This is not my number. This is their number. The estimated cost, $10 to $50 trillion to the worldwide economy. So all cost and no gain. So this is just utterly irrational and was irrational. I'm glad the United States didn't fall for it. They're now, because of this, it just makes no economic sense. This is just complete idiocy. And so they can't manage to do this. They tried to do it in Copenhagen in 2009, you all remember, which was right after all these famous documents and emails were leaked about climate scientists sort of conspiring. And then there ended up snowing in Copenhagen, and there was a blizzard in D.C., and all the U.S. politicians had to fly back early. I didn't sleep for days when this was happening because I was writing on this subject. Kid in a candy store. All right, well, the estimates that we could, for about $200 billion, we could provide sanitation equipment to the rest of the world that doesn't have it, which is a lot of money, but it's minuscule compared to the cost of this, and at least it would almost certainly have a benefit. So this just makes no sense economically. What makes the most sense, let's assume that it does at some point come to be a problem. There are things we don't understand. It's very unlikely that we're going to be using a petroleum-based economy 100 years from now if we're here. But at the moment, for most uses, hydrocarbons are the most efficient, least expensive, and most energy-rich sources of energy for most things, especially things like transportation. You see all these kind of documentaries that talk about those sort of wonders of free wind and free solar energy. This is just weird. I mean, this is like saying, well, look at all this energy, free energy right here in the Earth's crust. The issue is how you get it, right? So the problem is that the ways in which we capture solar and wind energy are very expensive and they're very diffuse sources. We're not going to cover the planet with solar panels, and it would be incredibly expensive. And so there's a basic economic reasons why we're still using hydrocarbon. If we develop technology that's more efficient, just basic economics will lead us to use that. And so I think even if there is going to be some warming and it's bad, I think by far the best policy is to support economic development policies, because countries that are wealthy are have a much easier time adjusting to change than poor countries. And so I think there's, if anything, a moral mandate to help other countries develop so that they can adapt to whatever is going to happen. So I know it's a kind of a complicated subject, but you've followed at least half of it. I hope you'll understood the issue better than you would have otherwise. It's also important to keep our sanity about sort of environmental things, because Americans forget all the things, cholera and dysentery and malaria and poisonous water and things like this, that we've solved. Most of us don't know people that have died of dysentery or cholera unless they were on the mission field or malaria. And that's because they had to go someplace else. This was actually in the New Yorker a few years ago, and I thought this puts it really well. Is it to these, you know, stereotypical cavemen in their hair shirts or something's just not right. Our air is clean, our water is pure, we all get plenty of exercise, everything we eat is organic and free range, and yet nobody lives past 30. That's it's a good perspective to remember that a lot of the really bad environmental pollutants and killers we have actually solved, and a lot of that stuff has still not been solved. People are still burning dung in their huts in Africa and breathing that air. And so if we're going to make this a priority, let's actually focus on some of these things we could do something about. Thank you very much.